Blog Talk Radio.
Those who dare to travel in the spaces between the lines. This is Shadow Travels with your hosts, Kevin Cook and Ray Sazone.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Shadow Travels. This is one of your hosts, Kevin Cook, and joining me, as always, is teammate and co-host, Ray Sazone. How's it going, Ray?
It is good. Life is good. We're not getting pounded with snow like we were last week, so no complaints here. And we have an amazing guest this week.
Yes, we do. This is very excited about this one. We've only done one crypto show to date, and that was, that was quite a while ago. It was last summer, I think. So this is only our second crypto show, and tonight we have on the Squatch Detective himself, Steve Culls. If you're not familiar with Steve's work, he is the foremost expert on Sasquatch behavior. And luckily we have some of our teammates calling in who are probably more versed in this than you and I are. I know that they're very excited to be calling in tonight and have a lot of questions for Steve. He is a co-founder of Extreme Paranormal Response Team. He's also involved in, and this will be very interesting, demonology and spiritual warfare, which I can't wait to ask him about. He's the author of two books, 50 Large, The Real Story of the Georgia Bigfoot Body Hoax, and What Would Sasquatch Do? Using Primate Behavior to Validate the Sasquatch Mystery. And he's been on quite a few TV shows. He's appeared on the History Channel. He's been on Fox, Destination America, National Geographic Channel, and several local news programs as well. So he knows his stuff, I think. There is no doubt about that. And I do have what I hope are some pretty, I guess, different questions for him. But, again, my base knowledge, you know, Ray, kind of like yours, I think, is pretty pretty generic in this subject, so it'll be good to learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my area of interest as far as Steve is concerned is more in the realm of demonology. But, you know, with our show here, Shadow Travels, our goal is to have different people on who can talk about the unusual or the unexplained or the unknown. And, you know, this is something that is still unexplained and unknown and unusual. And really, like you said, Kevin, my knowledge is it doesn't go very far beyond Harry and the Hendersons movie back when I was younger,
right?
As far as Bigfoot goes. But very excited. I'm very interested to hear what Steve has to say tonight.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, like I said, I have a lot of basic questions for him that I hopefully aren't insulting to him, but I think you know, that's kind of where we have to start, and I'm quite sure he's going to have some good answers for us. And he'll be joining us in just about a minute or two. He'll be calling in here. So anything else on the paranormal front?
A lot of times when people ask ask me about the paranormal or the show, you know, based on different guests we've had, and even with what we do with the investigations, people say, do you really believe in this stuff? And, you know, I kind of laugh, and you know, I wouldn't be doing it if I don't believe in it. But there are things that are out there, you know, cryptozoology. Of course, I believe in that. There are new species found every day that were obviously undiscovered. So, do I believe these beings, these things exist? Absolutely. And that's what I tell people, you know, we don't understand, but that doesn't mean they're not out there.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, hopefully Steve will have some insight on the other cryptozoology, creatures, I guess you want to call them that, because we'll definitely want to talk to him about that. As a little self plug for us, on April 1st, we're going to be, if you're listening locally anyway, in central New York, we're going to be at the Friends of Rogers Nature Center, and we're going to be doing a cryptozoology presentation down there. And our teammate Dan is going to head that up, because that's kind of his specialty. So if you're in the area, stop by. It's a small donation to the Nature Center, and you'll get to see our presentation. So it should be a lot of fun. I see that Steve has just called in, so we will go ahead and switch over to him, and we can get this discussion going and with all of our questions.
All right, sounds good.
Steve, how you doing?
What's up, guys? Good, what's up, guys?
Thank you so much. Great, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure.
I'm very excited to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, for sure. We got a lot of questions for you, and I think we're going to have a couple of callers tonight, too, that really have some questions. We got some other guys on the team that are really, really interested in your story and all the things you've been doing.
Awesome. Well, I hope somewhat I can add some enlightenment while being enlightened, and that's the beautiful thing about this is that there's always something new to learn. And
absolutely, and I think, yeah. And Ray and I were actually just talking about that, just before you called in, is that we're really hoping to expand our knowledge on this. So I guess the same question, if we were to have, say, a specific paranormal guest that we usually start with, is how did you get involved in this?
Well, a lot of people know that that years ago, I've been an investigator for a number of years. And in 1998, I picked up a book by the name of Monsters of the Northwoods. And I was actually quite stunned to see that there was actually Bigfoot activity within, an hour, and in some cases an hour and a half from where I lived. And I, like many, many people, had believed that Sasquatch was just a phenomenon in the Pacific Northwest and maybe some sporadic sightings like in Falk, Arkansas, the legend of Boggy Creek. Never did I even realize that what was going on around me. So I decided that, after reading the book and looking at maps and him and Horn, I decided to start doing some internet research and started poking around. And really my thought process was, I bet you this is all going to be a bunch of hooey. And
right.
It turned out that it wasn't. I started talking to police officers and scientists and firefighters, all, these are, really dedicated professional people, some professional observers that had witnessed these creatures. And, they weren't lying. I mean, my background is in forensic interviewing. So, interview somebody, I was looking for all those signs to tell me that, please just give me a sign that you're lying. But in many cases, what I was seeing was just the opposite. I was seeing people who were obviously getting goosebumps as they're telling their story. Their jugular veins were distensing. They were getting heavy in the breath as they're recounting this, almost like PTSD. So they were definitely seeing something they believed to be a Sasquatch.
Now, I noticed, and again, I hope that the questions that Ray and I have for you tonight, they're probably going to be kind of basic, and they're probably ones that you've answered 1,000 times because our knowledge is limited. So kind of bear with us, and hopefully our other more expert teammates will call in. I noticed that you use the term Sasquatch almost exclusively. Is there a difference between that and Bigfoot?
No, none whatsoever. Matter of fact,
okay.
The article, the way Bigfoot got named was actually a media term. In 1958, there was a gentleman by the name of Jerry Crew. He was a bulldozer operator up in a logging, doing logging up in Oregon. And he had uncovered these huge, I believe they were like 18-inch tracks. And the bulletin on the Walla Walla Times said, there's a new kind of Sasquatch. It's called Bigfoot. And the guy had the cast. And that's how the term Bigfoot just caught a whirlwind. So, in fact, the funny thing is Sasquatch is actually a term that was coined in 1924 by a Canadian journalist by the name of J.W. Burns, who he was talking to the Salish Indians, and they had called it Sasquatch. So he had turned it to Sasquatch. And so it's definitely had a delineation over the years. But I use Sasquatch a lot because that's more of a traditional term. It just feels more comfortable and more, organic than a term like Bigfoot.
Right. Now, is there Is there any different names you've come across based upon the, you know, we have obviously us being in Syracuse and you being out east of us, mm-hmm. the Native American tribes in the area, do they have a different name for it that you've come across?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have a whole chart of them. I know the Iroquois called them the Adenarhe, which meant stonish giant. And there's others. I know the Micmacs called them the Gogu, which meant in their language the hairy man beast. And if you look throughout all the Native American cultures, and there's got to be over at least 100 of these different names for something called Sasquatch. And usually their definitions are really what defines their names. And some of them, a lot of them, believe it or not, had stonish giants or stone giants. And that's because of, I believe, some of the behavior. How many times do people see them just standing next to a tree watching, you know, like a stone almost. So that's where I think that name. But there's actually one that actually said evil guide who hides under the cover of woods, man of the mountain, you know, and these giants, you know. So there was a lot. So the Native Americans definitely knew they were out there as well.
And what's so interesting about that is I'm a history teacher, so obviously this part of this will really interest me, is that it's such a commonality. I mean, it's across the country, literally, you know, with Native American tribes. And it's not just in the Northeast. It's not just in the Northwest. I mean, this is something that shows up in almost every tribe across the country in some way, shape, or form, which if that's the case, you know, it's not just a story that people are telling.
Oh, not in the least bit. You know, how many legends have we heard about in the past that turn out to be actual, you know, creatures? I mean, the mountain gorilla was thought to be a tall pale, and that's why King Kong came out. It was a huge mountain gorilla.
Right.
And here we think these things are ferocious because those are the legends that were passed down, and it turns out they're there, but they're just very docile. You know, the giant squid, there's another one. For years, people said,
yes,
oh, that was just an old name, and boom, there it is. You know, when the Japanese actually caught one. So there's you know, the world is a magnificent place, still full of a lot of mysteries. And I think it would be arrogant presumption by us to think we've discovered every single thing on this planet.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, Ray had been just mentioning that exact thing. So Ray, I'll toss it over to you. I don't want to step on your toes here.
Uh-oh, did we lose Ray?
Are you there, Ray? Oh, I don't know. Ray, are you there? Oh, that's a first. It says he's still logged in. Okay. Right, let me just make sure. Yep, looks like he'll be calling back in. So, good, I get to ask you more questions until he calls back in. are there different, and again, I don't know the specific scientific classification for it, but within the Sasquatch community, are there different family groups? I guess that's the best way I can think to put it.
Well, you mean as far as different types of Bigfoot?
Yeah, I guess that's what I was looking to say. Yeah.
Here's the thing about the science of Sasquatch. There isn't any, really. There is a very little bit, and I kind of try to bring that to light. All I can say is that a Sasquatch is a primate. Based that it has articulate hands and feet, a large brain, a small snout, and that's by definition a primate. So other than that, you know, when we start going, well, are there different types? Are there different? You know, then we start to hypothesize, and we really don't know. So I can't honestly.
It becomes a lot more
speculative. I have theories, but my theory is no more weighted than, you know, the guy walking down the street, because I can just take a best guess, and that's all I'm doing is guessing.
Sure.
Like if there are different types of them. I don't know. You know, there's different races of Homo sapiens. They, you know,
mm-hmm.
as far as
right.
different families, maybe not, but different races, perhaps.
Right.
You know, is there dimorphism or the change in sizes? I mean, we noticed that too from East Coast to West Coast. The West Coast Sasquatch is seen more bulkier. the East Coast Sasquatches seem more lankier. The Southern Sasquatches seem a little shorter. So there are some, but that's nothing that maybe environmental factors can determine. I mean, look at the example of the two Koreas. In South Korea, the average South Korean, I believe, is like 5'9". In North Korea, the average Korean is 5'7". And that's because of the abundance of nutritious foods and nutrition.
Right.
So really, you know, that's the only scientific type of guesses I can make that make any sense or that has some scientific backing to it.
Well, it makes perfect sense to me. Perfect sense. I mean, natural factors determine, you know, who develops what and where. So that's, I mean, like you said, with humans, why wouldn't it apply to something else? In this case, a primate. Ray, I think is back now. Are you there, Ray?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
I hear
you,
Ray. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. We're just proving here that this is really live.
So, Ray, I'll talk to you because I know you had
for you, Steve.
Yep.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask. I know you've been involved with actually some debunking some different stories, and I don't know if you want to talk about that at all. But I'm also curious about for anybody who might not have read your books or seen any of your appearances on a number of shows, which we will talk about and promote. I'm curious to hear more about maybe some evidence that you've collected or any experiences that really stand out that people generally like to hear.
Well, I've had two really great experiences, and they came in 2000, I want to say, my mind is, it's been a few years, so I believe it's been in 2011 and 2012. In 2011, I had a 40 to 45 second sighting of one, anywhere from about 150 feet out. I hit it with my flashlight, and I could see the eye glow. And what had happened was I was in my camp, and everybody was kind of just chilling for a while. We were out doing our thing. We came back in, break time, let's sit, get warm, let's talk about things and re-strategize for the rest of the evening. I went out to my car, which was probably about 50 feet through a woody path out to my vehicle where I was going to get some batteries. I went in my car, I got some batteries, threw them in my vest. I lit up a cigarette, and I shined my light down the north side of the dirt road, which is downhill, and where a lot of activity has occurred over the years, and nothing was there. And I kind of, whipped around to the north side, which is uphill, and there it was standing there next to a telephone pole, a utility pole that's on this dirt road, and it was observing our camp, I believe, because it was in the fall, so the leaves had fallen. So we actually had a really good view of our campsite. Very common for them to be. They're curious about what we're doing. And I just froze, and I couldn't believe it. And it turned at me, and then it kind of turned around and looked. It didn't really turn its head. It kind of turned its body a bit, looked over its, kind of what's behind it. And it started focusing back on me, and it just kind of stood there and looked at me for a while. And I could see the eyes blinking because the eyes were glowing this reddish-yellowish kind of glow. Obviously, it looked like it had the tapetum, the biological item in the eye that, dogs and cats and deer have that reflect that light. And finally, after a period of time, and I would estimate it at about 40 to 45 seconds, I just kind of shook my light a little bit, and it just simply turned and walked into the woods towards the west. My campsite, I immediately called my ops team and our photographer out there because I had my videographer out there that night, and he's got this movie-grade night vision camera, so he came out. Meanwhile, while they're walking out, the base camp is reporting they're hearing something walking down the one side of the base camp, which coincidentally is where I had seen it enter into the woods.
Right.
So we kind of measured it up. I was interviewed pretty much on the spot about it, and you can see how I'm just kind of like, I was really awestruck by it. Not my first sighting, but my first really bare eye sighting with that. It wasn't through it. I've had a couple of night vision sightings. I had a thermal image sighting. I actually had another thermal image sighting in 2013, but nothing, you know, at this point in time, nothing really defied it. And seeing that, so okay, there it was, and the guys actually we kind of looked, checked what the height it would be, and we figured it was around 8 feet tall, and then we the guys and I let them kind of walk around a bit, actually found the scuff or the indentation in the dirt where it actually climbed up into the greenery, into the wooded area, and you could see the dirt on the video was still falling in, so it was tremendous. The second encounter I had was a year later in the same area, same campsite, and we were doing the National Geographic special, Paranatural, which also is being aired now as Monsters and Mysteries Unsolved on Destination America. We had driven all night. We were in Chautauqua that day, so we drove all day. It was like a 10-hour, 11-hour haul. We got up to set up camp. It was pouring rain. It was horrible. Nat Geo came in. They just said, "We know you guys are tired. Can we just do some quick interviews?" They were in and out within 2-3 hours. It was probably like, now it was probably like 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, midnight. I crawl into my tent. Everybody else crawls into their tent. And about a half hour later, I'm a diabetic, so every once in a while, you know, nature calls. So I got up to use a tree. I stepped out of the tent. And by that time, it was a full moon night, but it was overcast. So the clouds kind of looked like a big, almost like a nightlight type of soft light type of atmosphere. It wasn't like bright, like, you know, like a clear night, but it was kind of like a glow. And as I step out of my tent, I look to my left, which is where the vehicles were up that woody path, and crossing the path is what appears to be a 5-foot, long-haired, brown creature just running across. Like, I kind of startled it that I came out of my tent. And my first reaction was, I just kind of shook my head, went, nah, and used the tree. And about 2 hours later, I had to use the tree again. But that time, I took a flashlight with me. The next day, actually, was some really weird stuff started to happen. The first thing was one of our guys got up in the morning, and I remember him going out to his vehicle at 10 o'clock at night to get his pillow and blanket. He left them purposely in his vehicle because just in case his tent leaked or anything, he didn't want to have his pillow and blanket all wet. So at 10 o'clock that night previously, he had gotten his – well, that morning we got up. He's like, guys, something had left a birch log directly behind his vehicle. Don't ask me how, but we found it right across. Right. Pulled out of the mucky swamp and carried over there because there was no drag marks. So who would do such a thing in the middle of the night? And, you know, it's not like somebody would go into that little – very, very odd. So then the next thing is a little while later, one of the guys on the trip, actually one of the girls, found a 9-inch by 4.5-inch track, small by Sasquatch standards, but wide in the heel and flat-footed like a Sasquatch. And guess where it was? It was across that path in the direction of travel. So we ended up casting that. It was very clearly, you know, I saw a juvenile. This very well could have been a juvenile print. So there was a lot of little things to follow up on that. And the funny thing is until the log incident happened, I kind of didn't say nothing about the night before because I said, nah, I had to be a bad. I just had to be. And they said, well, he found a lot. I'm like, oh, my God, I didn't imagine it. But that's just me. I have a level of skepticism, even in what I do and I see. You know, I always try to keep it real, and that's, you know, that's one of the big tensions is that, you know, I'm always looking for a legitimate answer. And I was so convinced that I didn't, I must be tired. You know, but then we find all that's going on. So,
and I think that's that's very similar to us when we do our investigations. I mean, I think that's a great attitude to go in with, because it makes when something happens and you're able to kind of work yourself through it, it makes it all that more legitimate. We do have a caller who's called in, so I'm going to switch over to them, and we'll bring them on.
All right. Sounds good.
Hi, you're on the air. Hi. Who's this? Who's calling? Oh, are you there?
Hello?
All right. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on
Can
the
you
air.
Hear me?
Who's this?
You're on. Oh, all right. Okay, well.
Yeah, you know, I could be Dr. Ruth. Hello, you are on the air.
Steve, I was going to ask you, with both of these sightings, I know that you hear a lot of reports from investigators or whoever that there's also either noises or smells. Did you have either of those occurrences when you had your...
Not on my sightings, but in November of 2006, I was doing some call blasting and doing some tree knocking and doing the usual, and we heard this kind of moan, and we heard something moving around us. And we were hit with this smell that smelled like death, a skunk, and wet dog all rolled up into one, very musky and
black. Wow.
I never smelled. Now, in my early years, I was a paramedic. When I became an EMT at 19. I was a paramedic by the time I was 21. And I was a paramedic from 1997.
So you've smelled some pretty bad smells.
I've smelled dead bodies. I've smelled a multitude of things.
Right.
This was unlike anything I'd ever smelled. And just as it came, it went. But the amazing thing is, it's like, okay, let me go back. It's getting to be dusk. Let me go back and get the night equipment. And as we go back about 25, 35 feet away from us, perpendicular going across the trail, here was this track, and that became the Four Dan cast, which you see on my website.
Right.
When the Tale of Two cast, that was the 2006. Funny thing is, the next time we came back, we found the trackway, and there was several other footprints. We didn't bother casting them because it had been a couple of days. We go down into the valley, kind of tracking it where it may have gone, looking for the lowlands, moving along the creek. And all of a sudden, and now this is a good half mile away from where we were the last time, boom, that smell came back again, and then it disappeared just like that again, not to return the rest of the day. So very interesting, never smelled that again, and I've been back that area, you know, that year I've been back several times to that area and never smelled it again. So it wasn't something that was dead laying there. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. We would have kept smelling that. And smelling that, and we would have found it. But the problem is, we'd smell it, we'd try to go in the direction it was, and it'd be gone. You know, it's like, where did it go? Yeah. So,
now,
I, without a doubt, that was what I smelled.
Now, I have probably the question you're really sick and tired of answering, but I have to ask it because I've never heard a good answer to it, and I know you'll have one. If these things are so prevalent, how come they're not more noticeable? How come people that live in the middle of nowhere aren't running into them on a regular basis?
Well, here's the kicker. Number one, I think there are a lot, for every sighting that we know about, and let's face it, since finding Bigfoot, there's been a lot of sightings. But there's probably, for every one sighting that gets reported and we know about it, there's probably at least 10 or a dozen that we don't know about. The people don't know who they never follow the Bigfoot community. We, you know, us in the Bigfoot community, we know they're there. But the common folk may not even cross that path. You know, it takes them a while sometimes to find that path. I think they're seeing a heck of a lot more than people think. You know, you know, the BFR database, if you flush out a lot of the garbage reports that are in there, they get reported every year. But there's still a good fair share of legitimate sightings. And you find these things usually in clusters here, there. And, you know, that's what I kind of key on. So,
okay.
And I think their defense is evasion. they say if they feel a threat, they're primates, so they forwardly think, and they definitely see us as a threat at the same time as a curiosity.
Sure.
So if we do anything,
right.
they get out of there before we even know it.
All right, that's a fantastic answer. That's the best answer I've heard. we have our teammate Dan, who's going to be doing that presentation, Steve, that you and I have spoken about in a couple of weeks down in down at the Nature Center. He's called in, and I know that he has a couple of questions for you. So I'm going to click over to him, and I know he will be there. So Dan, you're on. How are you?
Good, Kevin. Hi, Ray.
Hey, Dan.
Steve,
welcome.
Welcome. Thank
hey,
you,
what's
Steve.
Going on,
Dan? Not much. It's a pleasure to talk to you. This is kind of a big deal for a layperson like me to talk to somebody so esteemed in the field. And I just have a couple of questions, observation type things, and that maybe can help me get my presentation ready in a couple weeks. I mean, I got a bare bones, but anything that you could add. But first of all, I'd like to say I really appreciate your approach, the skeptic's approach, and that's what kind of drew me to the Syracuse Paranormal, because that's the approach that we take as a group. And it, even though I watch it every week, I get kind of tired of this, on Finding Bigfoot that, you know, a tree snaps because a bird landed on it and it's a squatch, you know. And I think that goes a long way towards pushing it to the realm of fantasy, whereas to me there's plenty of evidence, especially eyewitnesses, that have seen things, and you have something like the Patterson-Gimlin film, but people still think it's fake. And I appreciate your how you deal with that. One question I have, though, being a teacher like Kevin is, and mm-hmm. Supposedly being an educated person, when I talk to people about the subject of Sasquatch or even the paranormal for the first time, I get that blank stare. Then they look at me like, you know, wait a minute, aren't you an educated person? Why do you believe in that? How do you deal with that? You know, like if somebody, when you encounter somebody that's a skeptic, just because.
Well, usually it's, I just ignore it for a while. If they're sitting there during a presentation and they're acting skeptical, at least they're sitting there with an open mind because they're sitting through a presentation about something they don't believe in.
Right.
So the whole idea there is just use good, simple logic. Use your science. Look at science theory, where it's gone, where it's been. Things that I have found that kind of amaze me that, you know, such as, well, you know, people say Bigfoot talk to me, or how come people get creeped? They're supposed to get creeped out when, well, creeped out when the Bigfoot's watching them. Well, infrasound. There's a great idea. It suggested they may use infrasound. A lot of people don't know that the biggest mammals of each species, usually have the ability to use infrasound. The blue whales, the elephants, the lion and tiger, the big cats, you know, so all these animals are the biggest in their species, yet they can use infrasound. So if a Sasquatch obviously is a primate, it would kind of make it the biggest primate. So therefore, it's not a stretch to believe that it would have infrasound.
Sure.
And when you start breaking down each argument of the discussion like that, people all of a sudden start to open their eyes, say, wait a minute, there's actually a science. Like, you think that footprint's false? Or, so let's take a look at these two footprints. You know, why are they saying? You break down the science, the basic investigatory science. Like,
right.
Hey, you know, when we take a print, we take three separate measurements, heel-toe, heel-heel, and toe splay. And two of those three should be the same, but the third one should be different. And then I explain to them why. You know, the toe space should be different. And the reason, and if it is, you know what that is? And they kind of look, no. It means somebody stamps them out.
Right.
And then people go, and you see that connection start to handle. So then they look at these two prints that I have the same individual that were taken 2.5 years later. And they go, huh, now I'm starting to crack that little bit of toughness on them.
Right.
And if I'm lucky, if I'm really lucky, they may go away and say, well, I still don't believe it, but you know what? You know, just maybe. So
well,
if you can just crack them a little bit like that, you are never going to convince a skeptic or somebody who completely does not believe. That would be like somebody who goes to church every week to say all of a sudden that God doesn't exist.
Right.
Now, believe me, I'm a religious man, so I don't say that. But that's an example I would use to say, you know, this is your core, this is a person's core belief. Not only do we have religious belief, but we have scientific belief too. So when that defies, that's what our mind has been programmed for. So some people have had more programming than others. Some have had less programming than others, or different programming.
Right.
So when you get those people that have that tough programming, you're never going to crack them. It's going to take a Bigfoot breathing down the back of their neck to have them crack.
Now, what would you recommend? Because I've done a lot of research on the film, the Patterson-Gimlin film, and a lot of people's perception is that that's fake, even though it's really never been proven that. And you know, I read Bill Munn's book about it, which is about as detailed as you can get with an investigation. But besides that, could you recommend any other like evidence that maybe isn't so mainstream that you know, I could present to them to say, hey, look, here's what happened, and you know, you can draw your own conclusions?
Yeah. Well, besides in any presentation having a pack of Rolaids on hand, I suggest that the pieces of evidence that I have seen, you know, you'll have folks that will, you know, cart out. Unfortunately, they will cart out stick formations and rock formations and no evidence to attest whatsoever that Sasquatch caused this.
Right.
So, you know, what I do, the only thing I can speak for is the evidence that I usually drag out is, you know, my two casts, the baby footage, New York baby footage in 1997, and I bring out the Vermont Trail Camp photo picture, which still people want to argue that's an owl, but in each scenario of those, I have actually, in one case, the Vermont Trail Camp photo, I brought a scientist in who is an optic scientist. This was his profession, looking at for photographs, and he actually explained how this can't be anything in front of the camera. So whatever it is, it's large and it's on the ground.
Yeah, and it's huge.
Yeah, and it's
huge.
Go
ahead, I'm sorry.
And, of course, the baby video, which was taken in 1997 accidentally, not discovered until 2002, passed on to me in 2003, and I'm the one who kind of got it out to the world. You know, that in itself is an amazing video because it has a large figure in it and a small figure. And the small figure is definitely something that's not human. It's climbing up a tree hand over hand, swinging in the tree, hanging down. But it defies any logic why that would be a monkey or somebody's pet or monkey because of so many different reasons.
Now, this is the footage from the Catskills. Is that correct?
Not really the Catskills. It was in Modena, which is just south of the Catskills.
Okay, but in that area. Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I know which one you're talking about. Okay, so that one would probably be a good one.
I wanted to ask we had a little delay on there. I just wanted to jump in real quick only because you were mentioning various pieces of evidence, and I'm curious as to your opinion on this, and strictly in a professional sense. I'm a huge Survivor Man fan. He did an episode on Bigfoot. I'm sure you've seen it on Sasquatch. And he really focuses, Les Stroud focuses on bent trees that have kind of been bent in a 90-degree angle. What's your take on that? Obviously, they didn't find any fur. They didn't find any droppings or anything like that. But they really couldn't come to a conclusion as to what may have done that. Have you ever come across anything that like that when you've been out? Or what's your opinion on the whole bent tree 90-degree angle thing?
Well, a couple of things. To bend a tree at 90-degree angle and to make it survive that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I haven't seen the episode in question, but there's a couple of things. Number one, Native Americans used to make trail markers or markers in the wood, and what they would do is they would tie a tree down for about 6 months, a young tree, and it would grow in that 90-degree angle. That's number one. Number two, I have done a lot of studies on ice damage in trees. And strangely, all these tree bends have been coming in places such as Canada, you know, the northern United States. And that makes a lot of sense because, you know, as the ice builds up in some of these trees, it bends them over. And if they're there for a few weeks, they actually begin to grow that way. They kind of, you know, like the rigid tree snaps in the wind, but the willow bends.
Right.
And then, you know, and that's what happens.
Right,
it
yeah,
bends,
sure.
These trees bend, and then they just continue to grow that way because they can't just straighten up.
Okay.
So that's, you know, what people don't understand, when you see a tree bend, that just doesn't happen. If it just stays like that once, it breaks. You physically have to keep that down for several weeks. So it makes no, you know, to me, you know, if I was an arborist, I would be calling shenanigans.
Sure. Okay.
But,
fair enough. That's. I'm sorry, Dan. I didn't mean to cut you
That's
off.
That's fine.
With anything.
That's fine. I just have another question, actually, because something you mentioned a little bit, Kevin. What about vocalizations? What's your experience with those? And I know that's a big part of, you know, some of the TV shows, which really don't do the whole science of it a service, in my opinion. You know, I think it's like trying to talk to a dog by barking at it. I mean, the dog knows that you're not a dog. So I'm not sure of the validity of going out there and doing howls and grunts and stuff. But what's your take on that, Steve?
Well, a couple of things. First, let me just touch a bit on we have to understand, those shows are not meant to do a service to science. They're meant to entertain people. And the people that run those shows, not the teams themselves, but the people that produce the shows and generate revenues for those shows, they want a show that's based on entertainment value. And a lot of times, think of the PBS, you know, or the old, yes, there is the wolf on the plane. And, you know, you're like, oh, that's cool. You know, so you got to understand that. I know the Finding Bigfoot team, and they try their best in the little minuscule amount of time they can but they're on a production schedule.
Right.
You know, they just can't say, well, we're going to spend 4 days here. No, we're here for three days, and that's it, you know. And the second part, the vocalization thing, there's a couple of things. Do I believe Sasquatch howls have been captured? Absolutely. Do I think howling back at them necessarily is garbage? Yes and no. You know, there's people, well, you don't know what you're saying to them. It doesn't matter. Even if they don't know, you got people people have a hard time understanding that Sasquatch is a primate and primates are naturally curious. So even if you're a human hooting and hollering, you're damn straight you're going to come looking to see what's going on if they're in the area because they're curious. Think of it as if you're sitting on your front porch, and all of a sudden down the block you hear a kaboom. Now what does the dog do? The dog hides underneath the wooden bench on the porch. But what do you do? What the hell was that? And you get up and you start looking to see what it was.
That's
our primate nature, right? So you can do all kinds of noises. The whole idea is to attract their curiosity. I've done one step better. I no longer scream, hoot, or holler. I don't even tree knock. Well, I mean, I tree knock a little bit, but what I do is I use a call blaster and let the call blaster do it. Because I can put legitimate Sasquatch sounds, what I feel are legitimate Sasquatch sounds. I can put different animal sounds on it. And strangely, one of the more interesting ones that actually has elicited some kind of behavior is the baby cry. We put a baby cry, you blast a baby cry, and boy, there's a lot of interest going on.
Very interesting.
It is. And I just thought up another question, probably, again, oversimplified, Steve, but we had mentioned earlier in the show, and I don't know if Dan had been tuned in at that point, how we think that there's different types of Sasquatch in different areas of the country. Do they move around from locate from area to area, or do they do the ones in the Northwest primarily stick in that area? I mean, have you come across any instances of some from the South being observed out West or something of that nature?
No, nothing really that drastic. I'm sure, not to say that maybe one or two or five have eventually wandered, you know, that far, because, you know, that's just primate behavior. You know, the lonely, the solitary male is now trying to find his own troop or create his own troop and whatnot. And, but, you know, primates will migrate based on food needs and weather needs sometimes. So I'm not saying the Sasquatch migrate to Florida, otherwise we would,
Goes
the geese, there goes the duck, there goes the Sasquatch. But what we do see are some slight movements, very similar to that of course, the Aboriginal Native American, the Aboriginal Homo sapiens of North America, the Native Americans. And Native Americans had summer homes and they had winter homes, and it was based on food source. So it's very common for primates of all sizes and shapes to do that. So it's not unheard of that they may move around, although it's not like a bird migration or, you know, a... And, you know, a lot of people ask me, too, well, you think they hibernate? No, we don't. Mammals, well, I'm sorry, not mammals, but primates don't have the metabolism to hibernate.
Right.
Because we have those big, powerful brains that we need to keep tooling all the time.
Now, are they, from what you know, are they strictly omnivores? What's the primary diet from what you can tell?
Well, what I would think is that they have to be omnivorous. I'm sure they scavenge too, given their intellect, you know, because, and people say, well, how do you know their intellect? Well, they have a large brain capacity, even a chimpanzee who, actually the chimpanzee right now is the closest thing DNA-wise to a human, to a Homo sapien or human being, and look at the vast difference there. But they have forethought, they have abstract thought. They problem solve without the problem in front of them, and that's what a Sasquatch, I'm sure, does as well. You know, a lot of people want to attribute supernatural or paranormal powers to them, or super intelligent powers, or I love the forest people or the forest friend people that think, that, oh, well, a Sasquatch communicates and listen. Nobody has ever seen a Sasquatch use fire, a complicated tool, or even wear shoes, for that matter, in the wintertime. So to me, you know, they're showing, you know, the intelligence of a great ape, maybe even a, but whether or not it's pongid or hominin, I couldn't tell you right now either. It may be even something completely different from either one of those branches of the primate tree. So,
Lorraine Warren write about something in a book about communicating with Sasquatches before? It reminds me of that when you mentioned that about the telepathy.
I have not had a reference to that or known about that, but
I'm going to dig out the book. I know I got it somewhere. I'll be interested to see what she said about
but
that.
But I'd be interested to see if, you know, a person with psychic abilities could reach out to other animals as well. I mean, we have people that do, you know, pet readings. So if that's possible, I'm sure it's possible. Or, you know, if somebody can read pets, then they probably can read a Sasquatch too. I mean.
Now, Dan, did you have any other questions for Steve? I was going to shift gears just for our last 5 minutes because, believe it or not, our time is almost up.
I think I'm done. I pretty much got what I needed. Got some great insights with some stuff to add. So I appreciate you taking my questions and my call.
Oh, anytime, Dan.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thanks, Dan. We'll
be talking
to you
soon, Kevin.
Have a good night. All right, Steve, I know that this is a topic that Ray was really wanting to get into with you, and I definitely have some questions as well, and we're going to try to do it all in 5 minutes because, of course, it's a two-hour-long topic. But,
it's the lightning round, Alex.
There you go. Absolutely. It's perfect
Ray,
segue,
I'll,
too.
You
know, Dan mentions Lorraine, and, you know,
right,
Lorraine
that's what,
Warren,
that's what got me
very
thinking.
Well-known. Yes, a very well-known demonologist, and I'm thinking what he could be thinking of. I know they write, she wrote about an experience with lycanthropy, but Steve, I know you also have a background in demonology, and you know, with our very limited amount of time, I'm curious to talk a little bit more about that. I know, you know, I've had some experience, I have some interest, I've done some reading. I've been fortunate enough to go and spend time with at Lorraine Warren's house with Lorraine, and you know, go down in their museum and take a look at you know, all of their relics. I'm curious just to know what your background is with demonology.
Well, I was kind of thrust into it. You know, I've done a lot of communication throughout several years, reading up on the topic, and you know, we have a spiritual advisor who's really good, and when I have questions, I usually talk to him. But to me, my demonology, to be a good demonologist, it really, to me, has to come from within. You have to have faith and strength. And, you know, I am a Christian demonologist, and that's my faith. So, and I feel that a lot of it has to come from within. If there's a lot of people that have different practices. I try to, I love what Ed Warren had said. I've done a lot of reading on the Warrens. And I love what Ed Warren has said, was that the Catholic ritual has always seemed to work, and stuff like that. And, you know, as far as the prayers, and I've been given prayers by our spiritual advisor, who's, I don't know if you probably guys know him, Father Billy Clark. Holy Catholic. And, you know, he's given me a lot of prayers and a lot of different ways of dealing with things. And that's what I do. To me, I'm also ordained. But the heavy lifting I generally will leave for the clergy. But if there's something like an emergency, we have the prayers. And if we can't get clergy, I've done a house cleansing a couple of times, actually, and I've actually performed an emergency exorcism one. And it's kind of funny, the exorcism and the house cleansing, we had one affected individual in the house. The results were the same for both the exorcism and the house we were cleansing to the affected individual. So it was very, very unique experiences. But I don't talk about demonology a lot, because I personally feel it's not for my glory.
Right.
You know, it's his glory. So I really don't talk about it a lot. I don't really necessarily. I feel like if you start talking about it, it starts bringing bad things to you. You know, to
right.
me, it's
I
like
agree.
That thing you have to pull out as the last resort.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have about 2 or 3 minutes left here, Steve. So I did, first of all, want to thank you, and this is kind of a little promo plug for us, but also a legitimate thank you to you for volunteering or offering, I shouldn't say volunteering, for agreeing to come to our Paracon in August. It's going to be a great time, and you are the only crypto person who's going to be there, so the stage will be yours for this.
I'm looking forward to it, too.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great time. We have some fantastic speakers, of course, a lot of people that you know and you're familiar with, and a couple of new friends that we've made, as well as a lot of teams. So that's August 12th. If anybody, again, locally is listening or wants to make the drive to Syracuse, it's going to be a great day. August 12th at the Barnes Hiscock Mansion on James Street in Syracuse from 10 to 6. Steve will be there, as well as Dan Klass from Kinsdale House. Chris DeCesare is going to be there, and a number of other people. It's going to be a fantastic day. So, and Steve, of course, we always want to give everybody a chance to, you know, kind of plug yourself on here. I know you have a radio show, so if people want to tune in and listen to that, how can they do that? How can they get a hold of you if they want to report seeing something? You know, what's the protocol for all that?
Well, the radio show is on a hiatus because we had a radio network, but that seemed to have we had a little technical problems towards the end of November or end of November, October. We have since they have since closed the radio station, so that's done. We're looking for a new home. We're working on it right now. But as far as getting a hold of me, well, of course, I'm on Facebook. I have a personal page. I have a fan page. I have I still have the radio show page as well. I'm on Twitter, Squatch DET, Squatch Debt. Or you can go to SquatchDetective.com, and all the links to everything will be there, including a way to contact me, including a way to report a sighting or do a contact request. So I can do all of that right through the website. And, of course, that's SquatchDetective.com.
Excellent. And I know you had mentioned, and I'm just going to put this out there generically, is there any announcement that you wanted to make on the show tonight? I know you had kind of mulled over something that maybe you wanted to talk about.
I didn't know if we were going to have time to get to that, but I have another hoax that I have successfully busted. Right now I'm crossing my T's, dotting my I's, and lowercase J's, and we're moving forward to actually getting that hopefully published to the blog within the next week. It's really a bombshell. It's about a guy who took advantage of some folks because he had a little misfortune, and he dipped into the cookie jar a little too soon, and now we got people out. At least one person is out of grand. And as we look back at this guy's history, we realize that he did fabricate some evidence that he was trying to play on one of his expeditions. And when you see that, you're going to just shake your head and say, yeah, that's very definitively a fabrication. So should be really,
all right,
really
be on the lookout.
Yeah, and we'd love go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. And, of course, the right now the reaction I'm getting for said person that's pulling off the hoax and owes this money is that I'm looking for my 15 minutes of fame.
Right.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. That's, and once you fully break the story and it goes out there, we'd love to have you back on to talk about it in more detail when you can release more detail on it. So.
Absolutely, and even to do one better, I may have one of our actual eyewitnesses to the whole thing that actually gave me a lot of information. I can get him on too.
Perfect.
Oh, that's fantastic. Even better. That's great. That's great. We do have to wrap it up right now, and the hour flew by. Thank you so much for coming on and talking with us.
Guys, my pleasure, and we'll see you real soon in August.
That sounds great. Good luck with everything, Steve. Absolutely. Have a great night. Take care. All right, Ray, that was definitely a very cool show, and I'm glad we had him on. Are you there? Oh, looks like we might have dropped Ray again. Hold on one second. Are you there, Ray?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yep. I don't know what happened there. We got a little mix up with the call. So I was just saying.
I was just making my last Terry and the Hendersons reference. When Steve was talking, I was thinking about the ending of the movie, which is really one of my favorite parts, where he's going back out into the woods, and all of a sudden, all of these other Bigfoots, these Sasquatch, tall ones, all over, they appear out of nowhere, and, they were in plain sight the whole time. And it just, I don't know, I guess that's what I want to leave people with. They're out there. There are things all around us that we don't stop and notice.
And I think that Steve really communicated that very well. And especially with his evidence and with his personal experiences. So it was very cool. I gained a lot of information. I'm very glad he was able to come on, and I can't wait till he comes and speaks in August with us. So with that, we should wrap it up and send it over to the girls for Freaks and Geeks. But thanks, everybody, for joining us, and we'll be back next Tuesday night with another show. Have a good one, Ray.
That's right. You too. Good night, guys.